You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And for Dear Science this week, we're joined by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern.
Kia ora.
What does the world of science have for us this week?
Oh, some really interesting stuff this week. So first off, biological aging and how we grow up and how we're living affects our biological age. So first, a couple of concepts. Biological age is basically a measure of how old our cells and organs are at a molecular level. So it's as opposed to chronological age, which is how many years we've been alive. And so you can think of it basically as it's a measure of the wear and tear that's been gone on your body. And so you can imagine, it's influenced by, you know, diet, sleep, stress, genetics, your environment. And so it's quite a strong predictor of disease risk and lifespan. And the way that we basically determine biological age is we study the epigenome. And so the epigenome is basically a collection of chemical changes that happen to our DNA that affects when, where, and how our DNA is actually expressed. And so to measure this, the final concept is epigenetic clocks. So we use these epigenetic clocks basically to measure epigenome stage changes that are associated with age. And as you can imagine, there's been a lot of different types of these epigenetic clocks developed. So there's a first generation, which was just about trying to guess chronological age. There was a second generation, or is a second generation, which are more about predicting health-related outcomes and mortality. And then the third generation are trained on longitudinal data, so they're taken, multiple samples taken through someone's life and on a large number of people, and it's kind of giving you a more of a concept of how fast you age, so your aging rate. Now, what a lot of previous studies had indicated was that these epigenetic clocks and their measures are sensitive to socioeconomic, racial, and ethnic disparities, which is kind of, it is interesting and good for us to understand in terms of bettering our society. But it was kind of unclear which the epigenetic clocks best captured these effects and what social determinants were having the most effect on health, what stage of life, had the most effect, what the socioeconomic exposure had the most effect. So there was a whole bunch of questions.
A complex set of questions.
Yeah, you know, right? And so what this study was able to do is they've accumulated the data from 140 other studies. So this means they have data from nearly 66,000 individuals. So a big, big data set. And they wanted to see if these associations between biological age and socioeconomics were actually consistent and robust. So it wasn't just that one study found it, but not another study. You know, like having all this data, it's to really go, yeah, no, this is actually a thing. And what they did find was there is actually a robust pattern. So people who experience social disadvantage tend to biologically age faster. And so this was actually strongest when they used these newer, so these second and third generation epigenetic clocks. But what was really interesting is that it starts early in life. So children growing up in poorer conditions, like lower socioeconomic circumstances, they will biologically age faster. And even once you become an adult, if you grow up in a disadvantaged family, you'll still age faster even later in life than even decades after that childhood exposure. So it kind of, it sticks with you to some extent. And then there was some US-based studies that were part of this larger, this accumulation of studies where they were able to look at racial discrimination and how it affects biological age, and there was an association. And so what this kind of study fundamentally says is, like, yes, these epigenetic clocks are useful. There is this robust association. And then maybe in the future that they can actually be used to help evaluate interventions. So if you have a poverty reduction program or education policies and start to really go, yes, this is making a difference, or no, it's not. And yeah.
Always a difficult one. Right?
It's not necessarily a surprising result, but you do need a lot of data to actually go, yeah, this is real, this is robust. Very difficult.
Especially to get anything done, right? You need to have that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's going to just kind of wallow, and that's not good. We don't like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's potentially a good start.
Yes.
That's the optimistic way of looking at it.
Yeah, because there's been, with these epigenetic clocks, there's been a lot of discussion about how useful they are, because on a population standpoint, they're probably really useful, but people have then also started trying to use them on an individual level to go, you know, I'm this biological age, I'm in good health, or, you know, I've got to change these things. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Not the greatest indicator, I guess.
Yeah, no. You have to be a little bit more careful about interpretation of results when it's on the individual level, but, yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, what have we got up next? So I'm excited for this one.
I love the phrase wood wide web. So whenever I see a story about the mycorrhizal fungal network, I am there for it. And so this is about basically the first global map that's been produced of the arbuscular mycorrhizal network. So mycorrhizal network, it's fungi, it's under the ground, it's below forests and plant communities. And basically, these are these fungi where they have these really branched, thin threads called hyphae, and they branch out and they form basically a two-way pipe system that channels nutrients to plants and takes carbon from plants back into the fungi. Arbuscular specifically means that its hyphae actually enter the plant roots and then penetrate into the plant cells, so they really get their nutrient right there, whereas there's another form called mycorrhizal, which they penetrate into the roots but not into the cells.
Mm.
So just a minor sort of difference where this one focused on the arbuscular. And what they have done is basically, mapped the density of these things around the globe and found that actually in high altitude grasslands or flooded grasslands, so think the Everglades in Florida, this is where they're most dense, which was kind of a shock to me. I had never really thought about where they would be most dense, but it turns out where that is.
It kind of makes sense, but it also feels surprising.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's an interesting one, right? And like I think like you, I just like fungi.
They're such amazing
they're just
things.
Awesome, right? But there is actually a really significant reason for studying this in that, you know, I just said that they take the carbon from the plants, right? Mm. They're a carbon sink. And it turns out that they, about 3.9 million tons of carbon dioxide per year go into our fungal network, which is about 11% of the global fossil fuel emissions in 2021. So, you know, these are really important for the Earth's health, and we didn't really know where they were distributed.
Yeah.
So you can understand why these scientists went, oh, this is a little bit of a problem. And again, this is one of these studies that have taken a whole bunch of previous studies. So in this case, it was 322 previous studies, which had taken soil core samples. So you take a sample of the soil and then you're basically determining the density of these hyphae within it. And so they had data from over 16,500 cores. So again, a lot of data. And again, using AI to help with accumulating all that data and interpreting it to predict a map of this arbuscular mycorrhizal fungal network for every square kilometre of topsoil worldwide. So you can go online and you can see this map. It's very cool. And what's really interesting is the way, well, what I found really interesting is some of the numbers. So the way that you express density of these fungi in the soil is actually in a length over volume measure. So you basically think of stretching out the hyphae end to end, measuring that distance taken within a volume. So specifically, how many metres per cubic centimetre of soil. So a 1 by 1 by 1 centimetre thing of soil, on average, has 4.4 metres worth of hyphae. Like, so these things, these hyphae are really small. You have the runners, which are about 20 microns in diameter, and then from them, things that range from 1 to 10 microns in diameter, and then there's, like, the things that penetrate cells are less than 1 micron. So they're really tiny, so that's how you can kind of pack so much in. But it's just amazing. So, like, in those wild grassland areas where it's really dense, is 6.6 metres. And then the lowest density actually happens under areas of cultivated trees. So it's about 3.8. What's also really mind-blowing is if you stretch them all the ones from around the globe out end-to-end, They predict it's about 110 quadrillion kilometres, which is...
Just a bit.
About 10% the length of the Milky Way, or a billion times the distance of the Earth to the Sun. So we can't even really picture those numbers, right?
Just absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah.
What on earth?
And then, on the downside, what this map has also indicated is it does reveal that agricultural practices are decimating these underground networks. They can't say what agricultural practices, but they can see in the regions where there's a lot of cultivation that there's not as much. And so you can think, like, if you're using fungicides, if you're using phosphorus and nitrogen fertilizers, you know, they probably are having some effect on this fungi network. In the future, there does need to be a lot of more data come out of tropical rainforest areas and deserts, because, of course, when you're probably running your studies, you may be not going into the middle of the rainforest to try and dig at your soil cores. That's quite hard. Mm. Probably the same with the desert. So they predict in 5 years' time they'll have an update for this map that will be even more accurate and even cover areas with greater accuracy, so less uncertainty. But what they do hope is that maybe this will be used for making decisions about conservation and restoration, because then we have more of an idea of what's going on.
Because these are important networks. These are important networks that we shouldn't decimate.
Exactly right, and we don't really think about it.
And it's unfortunate that we don't think about them, because they're so cool.
Yeah, they really are.
Moving from a more grim, topic. So what do we have?
This is a bit grim. It's a little bit of a continuation on the primate theme from a couple of weeks ago. But a lot of people probably have seen the headline that 7% of the global population of this certain type of orangutan has been killed in a period of 4 days last year. So what it is, it's the Tapanuli orangutan. It's the world's rarest great ape. It was only classified as a new species in 2017, and it has the scientific name Pongo tapanuliensis. And it's been determined that it's distinct from the Bornean and the Sumatran orangutans. And so it lives primarily in the Batang Toru forest in northern Sumatra in Indonesia. So back in 2019, when they made an estimate of how many individuals were alive, it was the whopping number of 767 in the world.
Not a lot,
right? 581 of which were living in the forests of the western block of this Batang Toru. And like most animals, they've been pushed to the brink of extinction by habitat destruction, which became so much worse last year in November, when this area basically over 4 days suffered from this tropical cyclone, which brought on this extreme rainfall, which led to catastrophic landslides. So in 4 days, they got 56 centimetres of rain, like a lot of rain. Now, orangutans, like many great apes actually, are quite vulnerable to these environmental shocks because they actually have a slow rate of reproduction. Mm. Orangutans are only breed every 6 to 9 years, and they're heavily dependent on tree cover to survive. So when you get a lot of rain, that's kind of damaging your trees. It's a problem. When you get a lot of landslides that are damaging the ground in which those trees are, again, a big problem. So over 8,000 hectares of forest of this habitat, there were greater than 50,000 scars identified from landslides. And if you look at the way they've done this is they've compared pre- and post-cyclone satellite imagery. And you can see these images online and, like, post. Like, I didn't think it would be as obvious as it was, but it's mind-boggling. It goes from being just a picture of deep green to deep green and strips of brown everywhere. And so
it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it would. And so with these satellite imageries and these population estimates, this is how they get to this number of 58 individuals have died probably due to drowning, suffocation under landslides, and from collapsing trees. Because, of course, you might be in an area and you're moving to try and get away from it, but it's 4 days long, the cyclone, and so your chances are kind of low that you're not going to get some effect. So really, really bad for the biodiversity or for the genetic having its genetics, basically,
yeah.
having so much of it obliterated, the fact that it doesn't they don't reproduce very much or
it's
at a fast rate. So it's a big hit.
Yeah.
But it's going to keep hitting because it doesn't end there because, you know, like they require these trees to survive. These trees have all been knocked down, so they've got to regrow. You had landslides, which have taken out the topsoil. What's in the topsoil? The mycorrhizal fungal network.
Yeah.
That helps these plants grow. So the actual rate at which these plants grow is going to be affected by that. And, they need these leaves. They need these fruit to survive. And so it's going to take – hopefully they can bounce back. I think they say if in the next – over the next few years, if they lose even 1% of the population each year, they're probably not going to bounce back. But there's a lot of effort. Like the government of Indonesia – have actually stopped development in that area at the moment so that they can get a grip of like what is the extent of damage, how do we proceed from here, which is quite admirable. Climate change does mean that there's going to be an increasing frequency and intensity of these massive rainfall events. So fingers crossed for the Tapanuli orangutan.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of a
harrowing consequence of, I mean, us. Thanks. In case our regular destruction of their habitat wasn't enough.
We've
set up the world to do it for us.
Yeah. There was one story I read where it was a rescue worker who they were going in afterwards, and of course a lot of people lost their lives, but they were just, you know, like the first orangutan they saw was quite an impact on them, right, because they just hadn't expected to see it. And, yeah.
Damn, well... a sad note to end it on, but that's the way of science.
Yes.
Thanks, Kushla, for joining us. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, science. Ngā Kōrero Rererangi Aviation Conversations returns on 2nd of July. Enjoy a lively panel discussion on the dark sky movement, featuring guest speakers Nikki MacArthur, MNZM, and Josh Aoraki. Book now at motet.nz.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.